about the future of the world, you know, 9 out of 10 of them will tell you that, you know, the rich will be in some little enclave somewhere and the poor will be completely stuffed. And that's exactly what it is. So we need to take inspiration from things like Mossadegh to say, you know, we can make a protest. We can understand what's happening to us. And we can take control. You know, the only people who are going to change anything, so no one's going to change it for us. So we have to work out how we can change it in a way that the majority of people in this world actually, something like, the whole thing is reversal, so that people aren't at the mercy of some decision made in some corridor of power somewhere that no one knows about. And the other thing I should say about Mossadegh is that it's particularly about women also, but, you know, it's women were portrayed as this sort of, you know, very meek, very quiet, wonderful workers who will just be very happy to work for you and won't cause you any trouble. So it was fantastic that Mossadegh demonstrated that this is complete nonsense and that women, unbelievably, are human beings. How amazing. And feel angry when they're sacked. How amazing.
Is that the first time?
I think in Penang? It certainly was, I think. I mean, certainly in free trade zone history, Mossadegh was, about the whole 85, I think there'd been a, if I remember, there was a, I wasn't here in those days, but in 70, quite soon after the whole thing started, in 74, around 74, 75, I think the first free trade zones, I think somewhere around 76, 77, there was something like a small downturn, which had sort of given a little tremor. People had suddenly understood that it wasn't all going to be gold at the end of a rainbow. But that quickly kind of went over. So there would, there'd been, you know, 8 years of something like gold at the end of a rainbow. You know, everybody was working quite happily. You know, I mean, we all know the, you know, all, like earlier we were talking about, the, lots of people had been talking about how it's exploitative and, you know, global production lines, etc. And of course, you know, the actual production line is horrible in terms of health hazards and detriment. I mean, just lots and lots of things you can say about it, which are not positive. Health consequences for the workers, the free shift system, the actual chemicals used in the factory, the lack of rights and protection, etc., etc. So lots of things wrong. The patriarchy, of course, and so, yeah, so for women to show that, you know, we also understand what's happening to us and we are not happy and we can voice that and we will voice it. So I think that's an inspiration also that we can take. You don't have to shut up.
So what happened to Mossadegh in the end?
So in typical multinational strategy, tactic, or whatever you call it. Again, you know, my memory is very poor because this happened at lots of factories. There were lots of other incidents. Harris was a very famous case in Malaysia where union busting. So that was a bit later. And the same kind of tactic was used. I sort of get a little bit confused about, because my memory is useless. But certainly Mossadegh sold. As one way of escaping their responsibilities, when they realize that they're in total trouble, first of all, they sack all their workers. And then, like I say, I think they kept a little core group of workers. And I can't really remember exactly what happened, but they must have been thinking we will maintain a presence in Penang somehow or other. But I think they must have realized that actually this was it. And especially when the women workers were saying, you know, we demand our rights and we demand rights in terms of retrenchment benefits in particular. So we demand retrenchment benefits. And so they'd filed this case for retrenchment, okay? So they filed it, of course they filed it against Mossadegh. So companies being companies and being advised by company advisors who understand how to be criminal and generally not fulfill responsibilities. So they were clearly advised, sell your company or someone else buy your company and then you're not Mossadegh anymore. So then who are they going to claim now? So that's exactly what happened. They sold the company. I think to Thompson, I can't quite remember. Actually, I may be totally wrong, to a French company. Anyway, whatever it was, they sold the company, which of course makes the legal situation now rather complicated, because now who are you suing, actually, for retrenchment benefit? And to be perfectly honest with you, I can't remember what happened to the case. But I just know that this is a tactic that is used over and over again around the world, that you just create all these different companies, and then when something goes wrong with one, you just switch, close that one down and switch everything else to another. And of course, the workers get completely stuffed, as always. And that's exactly what happened in Harris as well. They kept switching company owners. So one minute you're trying to see these people, then you can't see these people, but now this, because, you know, and so they just manipulate the whole situation and refuse to fulfill any, even the most basic responsibilities, they just get away with. And, you know, if you look at around the world and tax, you know, the people, how companies avoid paying tax, it's just absolutely, you know, and this is basic responsibility, even a capitalist world, you know, there's sort of, but no, you want to maximize everything, so you just refuse any loophole you can find to avoid paying anything out. But meanwhile, of course, getting as much in as you possibly can. They will exploit. And so whether it's workers, whether it's governments that they want to screw up by not paying local taxes, whether it's local legislation that they want to get around, basically they will do it. And so, yeah. Again, we could learn that lesson from not just from Mostek, but for actually just look around the world and see, you know, that these people are utterly, utterly irresponsible. And without any commitment to any sense of humanity at all, even if, you know, the human face of capitalism, even if we accept there are bosses, you know, that we work for someone, at the very minimum, you would want a relationship that is at least somehow respectful and that you're protected by legislation that gives you minimum standard meaning a standard that is acceptable to us, not to them. So the minimum standard now is acceptable to them, and even that they will try and get round, and it's not us. So we take inspiration from things like Mostek to say, you know, we need to set the agenda. You know, even if we're working in the system, if we still maintain that system, the rights that we want enshrined in legislation and enforced by our government are rights that we are saying are minimum. This is the minimum wage. We won't work for less than that. These are the minimum in a situation where a factory does close down. This is the minimum process, and this is the minimum retrenchment benefit we will take. These are minimum standards, and we're setting them. We're demanding them. This is our society. This is where we live. And we're not going to live in a society where these things are not in place, because it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. What Mostek did is not acceptable. It's not acceptable that the state government reacts like that. It's not acceptable that the national government reacts like that. It's not acceptable. We don't accept that. So we work it out, how we make sure that it's not acceptable. So, of course, like I say, there's many different people with many different ideas about how to do that, but that's basic, absolutely basic. Otherwise, we'll just carry on in this very poor, extremely unbalanced world. People cannot all the time, and it's women cannot more than, you know, I mean, it's a hierarchy, right? The, you know. But so whatever it is, the workers.
Yeah. Well, you say we should also learn from Mostek. When you said just now there were three groups that split, then your group is like busy at doing income generating programs. Do you know what were the other two groups doing?
Well, the unions were the unions.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the three groups is a bit, it sounds like, I'm not sure it was quite as clear as that, but anyway, because we'd still see each other and talk to each other and stuff
like
that. Oh, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like we've declared independence at all. But you just know that, you know, we've gone down a path that certain people don't like us going, I mean, would prefer us not to have gone down. But you're still talking to them, of course.
Mm.
I mean, it's not like we've declared war or anything like that, nothing like that. But it was, people, even then, one understood that, you know, there was a feeling of fracturing. There was a feeling that things were falling, not going the right way, especially from certain people who were feeling like that. But if you ask what the agendas were, I mean, the agenda for the unions, MTC, for example, they saw this as an opportunity to reach unorganized workers, and that's what they sort of were doing. To be perfectly honest with you, MTC didn't really have the capacity to do it properly. They could have done, you know, if they'd really, I mean, it's easy to say, so this is a little bit unfair probably, but always, you know, you just look at something like MTC. MTC is has such a potentially important role because they're the only workers' organization who have something like the capacity to reach out and organize and unionize, because that's their job. And so their heart and soul has to be in it. But not only MTC, not only the trade union movement in Malaysia, but around the world. I mean, so often it somehow doesn't quite work to the way that you want it to work, for lots of reasons. Some of which is to do with the fact that officials become suddenly very happy with being an official and have lost their sort of heart and drive, you know what I mean? And much happier going to international labor organization conferences in Geneva and making nice speeches there. Because it's hard work organizing people and takes a lot of commitment and time and resources. So anyway, MGC were interested in extending their outreach and their influence on unorganized workers. So they kind of tried to do that. But like I said, not particularly successfully, I don't think. Electrical Industry Workers Union, who were the union who were actually had been in the forefront of trying to get the Electronic Workers Union registered and had taken on the government and so on. So they were, of course, looking also to cement their relationship with electronic workers and also to build momentum again for the campaign to register electronic unions. So they were doing that. And this is not to say that both of them were not supporting the specific things at MOSTEC, because like I say, I mean, MTC were very much helping with the processing of the forms for retrenchment. And in general sense, the lobby, if I remember, there were 5 lobby points that the workers had come up with, which were to do with retrenchment, alternative jobs, unionization, 2 others, which I can't quite remember at the moment. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean, so there were still some common
things that you do together.
Yeah, what we do together. And which were involved those two. And then for the urban services project, I think, but you need obviously talk to Len, because she will tell you her perspective and how she saw the future of that struggle at that time and what the role of the urban services project were in. But they certainly were trying very hard to build on the experience. So some of the women leaders, and actually some of the women workers, I think Len would see as potential for carrying on in the work in a very committed and determined way. So I think for her it was creating, but like I say, I may be totally wrong, she might have. I mean, you need to get it from her. But she was very much trying to offer opportunity for those workers who had that heart and that passion, just that value add to that, to something like bring them into the struggle for workers' rights and for women's rights and so on. So she would be very much about that. And so she, people like us who were doing income generating, we're very much part of that, but we're kind of diluting it by offering income generating and sort of other opportunities, which we were talking about this earlier. I mean, it was about options. So someone like Rahini, you know, she didn't want to go full time into becoming this, you know. I mean, she was already very active and very strong and her own person. So she wasn't particularly not to say she wasn't interested in becoming a woman leader, but she wasn't the sort of person who would join a training session over a period of time that would turn her into something, you know. She just wasn't that sort of person who would do that. So she had her own idea of where she wanted to go. And we supported her. So, I mean, you know, maybe we were wrong in supporting her, or maybe... And her, when I say her, a few. There were a few of them. So that's, you know, so that's where we were at. But like I say, it wasn't... there were still things, but, I mean, it did... And certainly when the money came in, and this money from Norway came in, and also I'd left at that time, at roughly the same time. And so that's when I think it kind of ended, in that sort of feeling of there was things happening, we were all together still somehow doing something. I think it kind of ended with that. But like I say, Lynn will have some of the story will be the same, but she will have a very different perspective. And you know, that's what's so great about oral history and about people being part of something like this, is that we have very different, not totally different, because I think, you know, we all share a commitment, a complete commitment to, you know, how awful this world is and how awful that situation is. And so when people start resisting, yeah, you support immediately, because that's your feeling too. But the paths that you take would be different, and your perspectives a little bit obviously would be different. So great when people talk, you know, different people talk about the same thing, because suddenly you'll suddenly get a very different perspective on the whole thing from someone, and then someone else will say something else. Just like, so it's like, oh, how interesting. But whatever it is, women workers said, you cannot treat us like this. And that was a big moment, actually.
Did that bring any changes to the worker force in Penang Free Trade Zone after Mostek? Let's say maybe in the factories, they are not interested in taking a lot of women workers after that. No?
They didn't take Mostek workers. Ex-Mostek workers, they were blacklisted.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the militants were blacklisted completely. They couldn't get a job. That was partly why we opened the Income Generating Centre, because there was no way that any of them could get a job. They were all blacklisted. Some of the Atlas workers, I think, were probably blacklisted. So the more militant workers were blacklisted, because that works as well everywhere in the world. But, you know, when you get militant people saying, you know, we stand up for workers' rights, the multinational, the companies will very quickly identify who are the ringleaders and will blacklist them, and you know, etc. So that works everywhere. So they were blacklisted. But in terms of employment demographics, so the thing that changed, there's really a lot of things have changed, of course, because the capitalists know exactly where their interests lie and how best to maximize profits. So one of the things that changed was that the production line was, so the free trade zone sort of start, this export-oriented industrialization, is like, you know, you have a particular production bit of your global production line in Penang, and it's a factory. And you employ people in that factory, and you make your chip, and then that is exported to somewhere else, which is then assembled into something else, and then, you know, finally packaged somewhere else, possibly, and then sold. So it's part of an assembly line, but it's global in nature, and your location of a particular part of that production line is in Penang. And so in those days, it was factory-based. So you employed a workforce, and you paid them, and then this happens, you know, but they rise up and they say, we get up, you know, you're treating us badly. So not all, but some of the production line, they rearranged it so that outsourcing became much more part of the industry. So somewhere like Dell, for example, although they have a factory in Penang, obviously, A lot of the parts of the computer is outsourced to other companies. So other companies will make things in Penang, and then it will come into the Penang factory, and they will assemble the final laptop, for example. So they're not making all the, so it's much more fragmenting, and a lot of factories, not all of them, were doing this home working. So the outsourcing, well, the outsourcing was actually to your company. So Huifei, Sindri, and Bahat would come to Dell and say, you know, I'm happy to take some of the production line off you. And actually, how you organize it is actually not really my business anymore. I don't care. As long as I get the product and it's quality control, that's fine. I'm happy. But Huifei, Sindri, and Bahat might well be using women workers at home. Housewives. I mean, not housewives, because they're workers, actually, but they're working at home. So home workers. And paying them absolutely minimum wage. And, you know, even more exploitative in every sense of the word. No health and safety, you know, terms and conditions, nothing. No retrenchment, nothing, you know. So I give you, today I'll deliver, I don't know, 20 things to assemble, and I'll pick you up tomorrow, and then I'll give you another 20. And so this sort of fragmentation, but there's a word for it which I can't remember, of the global production line, actually that happens. So outsourcing then becomes a much more integrated part of the production line. But, you know, I'm now not responsible for a lot of the products I'm using. And then, of course, now, as in now, 2015, the other thing that's happened is that the outsourcing of product manufacture is one thing. Now outsourcing of labor has become absolutely part of it. So even where I have a factory, actually I don't want to be responsible for my labor anymore. And the way I get around it is to outsource my labor. So, you know, instead of directly employing 1,000 workers, in the old days would be Malaysian, and I'd be bound by labor laws, even if I try to ignore them. But having said that, the multinationals, I mean, because the labor laws are fairly minimum, so they would respect rest days and overtime and all of that, and they would do that. But now, I'm not interested in any of that, and I will outsource labor. So now there's all these agents who are supplying labor. They're not supplying the product, but they're supplying the labor. And the labor, of course, now is heavily migrant labor. And so as an employer, I just want 1,000 people. So I go to Huifei, Sindri, and Bahat, and I said, I need 1,000 people for 6 months, and then I'll see what happens. So now I can control it. You know, after 6 months, maybe my factory's doing very well, I need 1,500. If it's not doing very well, I can do 500. But I don't have to retrench anyone now, because it's nothing to do with me. I just tell my supplier, my labor supplier, this is how much I want. So this is what's happening. And so now, that's why migrant workers now are so much part of the workforce, because the labor suppliers, the outsourcers, some of whom must be nice and honorable, but many of them are not, and are just out to make as much money as quickly as possible as they can. So again, the best people to exploit. In the old days, women were cheaper than men, so that was, you know, let's use women because they're cheaper and apparently more docile, blah, blah, blah. Now it's, you know, let's use migrant labor because they are definitely much cheaper and they don't know anything about their rights because no one ever tells them what their rights are, and they're completely vulnerable to all sorts of things, and I can exploit them to the hilt, and no one in Malaysia cares about them. So basically, I'm making fantastic amounts of money, thank you very much, and I have really no responsibility to labor at all. So it could be men, it could be women. And so now if you look at the factories, the free trade zone statistics, you know, migrant worker is a significant percentage of the workforce. And, you know, you just have to draw the conclusion, but it's just, again, it's for multinationals, it's just what can I get away with to make as much money as I possibly can and as little responsibility, increasingly little responsibility. I just want to avoid any responsibility. And, of course, when you play this tape, to the multinational, the Malaysian Employers Association, Electronic Employers Association, they will jump up and down and say, no, it's not, James is completely wrong, and you know, as we still directly employ people and we give them fantastic conditions and so on. So of course you still have companies that do directly employ people and you still have them having wonderful annual dinners and dances and supplying all the right, you know, support. But whatever it is, if ever something happens and that factory gets into trouble, they will have no compunction in sacking workers. And they will even think about, you know, giving them extra benefit, retrenchment. They will, of course they won't. They will do everything they can to minimize their obligations. And that's what MOSTEC teaches us, is that the system is not a system that is in any way about respect and fairness. It's about people maximizing profits. And if you're not in that category, but you're working for them, they will treat you. 1 minute they'll love you, and the next minute you're nothing. And that's MOSTEC's lesson.
Okay. So what about MOSTEC's lesson on you? I mean,
MOSTEC is on me, blimming heck. I mean, it was a very intense time, obviously. But it certainly isn't the first and won't be the last intense time in my life. It was a time when it was very inspirational. It's exactly the sort of thing that I love. I don't know if that's the right word. You know, when people are brave enough to stand up and say, you cannot treat us like this, just gives you a great feeling because, yeah, that's what it, that's exactly, you cannot be treated like this. Of course, you know, this world of ours is so badly arranged and you want to change the arrangement. But it's very hard. Clearly, it has been extremely difficult for people to find a model to change it, because the world is still badly arranged and getting worse arranged. So, you know, whatever struggle we're struggling with, we haven't found the answer at all. And MOSTEC is part of that. Is that, you know, it didn't change anything. You know, free trade zones continued. Employers to continue to abuse their workers. State governments continued to be state governments and national governments to be national governments and international governments to be international governments. So nothing changed. And so you know that already, but you're sort of trying to work out when I look at MOSTEC, it's like, it's just yet another example of, you know, how can that have worked to have changed something? Because it, you know, was there a possibility of doing something different but would actually have changed something? And, you know, who knows is the answer. But certainly, I mean, you know, if conditions were different and people were willing to chain themselves to come to, you know, and go on a hunger strike and do all sorts of, you know, very, very public and aggressive actions, which has happened elsewhere, you know, would that change anything? You know, maybe not. But that's the sort of thing you'd think of, is that we didn't do enough. We didn't do enough to put pressure where, but this is always the case. You know, now refugees and migrants, you know, some of the work I'm involved with. But that is that, you know, we've known about the camps in Thailand for years. We've known about the situation facing Rohingya in Penang or other refugee groups in Penang or in Malaysia, in Thailand, wherever it is. We've known for years. And, you know, you try to find ways of bringing it to lobby, you know, the lobby sort of strategy, and direct action doesn't really come into the Malaysia thing, but in UK and other places, you know, other countries, direct action is very much part of protest. Where people do chain themselves and do all sorts of, you know, stunts and stuff like that. And so, you know, there's been times when I've been back in the UK where you've been involved in that sort of much more direct action type of activities. And still nothing changes. You know, so we have to, you know, like I say, I mean, we're struggling with finding the right way forward for change. I think, and that's one of the difficulties of asking people to join the struggle, is that, yeah, but where are we going? You know what I mean? Because nothing seems to have changed. You know, you say you've been struggling all this time, but actually nothing's changed. So maybe it's a bit of a waste of time. So of course you'd say, of course it's not a waste of time. You've got to, I mean, you've got to do it. But one has to recognize that, you know, we haven't had many successes, or we haven't got the model. I mean, this is what everybody, you talk to lots of people around the world about models. I mean, Latin America, there's certain things which definitely people would hold up and say, you know, we can do it like this. This is one way forward. There's been times in countries where there's been suddenly good things happening, but not necessarily sustained over a period. And so, yeah, we're definitely, you know, the alternative, we all know that there needs to be an alternative, but actually, what does that alternative look like? And how are we going to get there? Clearly, we haven't got the answer to that. So I think Mostek was sort of part, I mean, it's just one reminder that we have a long way to go, and there's lots of, we still need to think about, I mean, we haven't got the answer, so where are we going to get the answer from? So then, you know, we quietly retire and leave it to you.
No, we will do together.
So me, yeah, exactly. So we have to, yeah, we have to recognize that. But I mean, yeah, the struggle definitely goes on, because otherwise there's no alternative to struggle. I mean, there's not an option not to struggle. Because like I said, if we don't say to ourselves, you know, we need to take control of our situation, of our society, of what's happening, of what the agenda is, of what we want. If we don't take control, whoever we are, if we don't take control, we'll be stuffed, which we are anyway, stuffed. So, I mean,